And this is The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. Yesterday, Donald Trump officially won the Electoral College vote after losing the popular vote in November's election. So because that happened, what is the point of the Electoral College? Former Washington State GOP Chair Kirby Wilbur says the Electoral College actually works really well. It has for generations. But Nation correspondent John Nichols wants to see the Electoral College abolished. So when I talked to John Nichols, I asked him about the Hamilton elector movement. That's what some Washington state electors are calling themselves. And their plan was to try and keep Trump from getting enough electoral votes. We know by now that didn't happen. But what if it had? Would that change John Nichols' mind about getting rid of the Electoral College?
No, it probably would have made me dislike it more.
Why?
Well, because they were proposing, at least some of them, were proposing not to elect the person who got the most votes or the person who got the second most votes, but somebody else altogether. The problem with the Electoral College is it is a radically, deeply, disturbingly anti-democratic institution. The last thing you would want to do is make it even more anti-democratic. So no, it wouldn't change my mind. The Electoral College should be abolished. It should not exist. It should never have existed.
So how do you think we should elect a president then, if not by using the Electoral College, John?
Yeah, I think we should just, you know, I've got a radical proposal. I know it's kind of way out there, but maybe we could do it the same way we elect school board members, city council members, state legislators, mayors, governors, members of the House, members of the Senate, and the way that presidents are elected in countries that we advise on how to develop functional democracies by giving it to the person who gets the most votes.
Okay, Kirby Wilbur, you think we should keep the Electoral College. Why?
Well, I think the Electoral College is a sign that this country is not a democracy. We use democratic processes, but it's a federal republic. And the Electoral College was set up by the Founding Fathers in the early days of this republic because it was an experiment. Nobody was sure what would happen, how it would work, that we were a totally brand-new system of government. The founders relied on their experience and their knowledge of history and politics. The Electoral College was set up to assure that the passion of the mob, if you will, that people did not make the wrong decision. And it's evolved over time to really represent the 50 states within the federal union, to really require a candidate for president to campaign throughout the entire country, not just the populated areas, and to make sure a president addresses the concerns of the different regions of the country. We have a very diverse country with diverse interests. We have agriculture, manufacturing, we have resource, we have people with oceanfront, we have urban areas and suburban areas and rural areas, and the Electoral College really does, I think, compel candidates to campaign in all the states and try and come up with a platform and policies appeal to people and suit the needs of all these various diverse elements within our country. And it's worked us well, it's done us well, and it represents us as a federal republic and the states within that federal republic. Therefore, since it isn't broken and it works, why change it?
Well, as you said, the Electoral College was it kind of forces presidential candidates to go out and campaign in all kinds of places and listen to all kinds of interests so that they can win the presidency. But we also learned this election cycle that at least Alexander Hamilton wanted the Electoral College to function as a way to keep a demagogue from getting into office. And right. So let's say that the Electoral College doesn't exist, whether it does or not. Should there be some sort of safety mechanism to keep a demagogue from taking office as Alexander Hamilton wanted?
Well, I think that is one of the purposes it serves, and that was its original purpose, to protect us from the passions of the mob and democracy. John says he believes in democracy, therefore if a demagogue got 47% of the vote and more vote than anybody else, I guess he'd be president. The Electoral College allows the states and smaller states and different interest groups to have some say in it, and it is the last line against demagogue, and I know a lot of people on the left think Trump is a demagogue. A lot of people on the right thought Obama was a demagogue. Somehow it's worked, and we have not elected a demagogue in 200 years of electing presidents, 225 years of electing presidents. It's worked so far. So I do believe in it as that, and I do believe electors have a responsibility in an extreme case. I don't look at this as an extreme case.
John Nichols, I am curious to know, what do you think will happen with our presidential elections if we continue using the Electoral College system?
Well, they'll continue to be unrepresentative and dysfunctional, They will be anti-democratic and, frankly, highly disrespectful of small states, of rural regions, of the full of the country. I couldn't disagree more with the fantasy that the Electoral College causes people to campaign in all regions of the country and to reach out to the whole nation. Nothing could be further from the truth. The fact is that many states in the country are barely ever visited by a presidential candidate. And, interestingly enough, where they do come to visit, even in some big states, it's usually a fundraise so that they can buy TV ads that then go back into a handful of Electoral College battleground states. So it's the opposite of that. What we will see as elections progress, if we continue to be in this model, very strong likelihood that you will have presidents elected with smaller and smaller minorities of the vote. Now, this isn't always guaranteed. You could still have a popular president. But what we now know is that as more and more Americans move toward the coasts and toward cosmopolitan centers in the middle of the country, there is a lessening of the influence of some interior western and southern states. Yet, these states will maintain, by and large, their same or similar level of electoral votes. So what you end up with is a situation where, in Wyoming, 55,000 votes will get you an elector for Donald Trump. In California, it takes almost 150,000 votes to get an elector for Hillary Clinton. So we're on a very bad track right now as a country. We are on a track toward less and less of a representative democracy and less of a circumstance where our presidents have the legitimacy that is conferred by having actually won the election.
Kirby?
Again, we're not a representative democracy. We are a republic with a federal system where the states, the federal government, local governments have different responsibilities, and the states are recognized as units within the federal union. They're not counties. They're not surrogates for the federal government. They're not administrative units of the federal government. They are states. And that's why when you want to amend the Constitution, you don't put it to a popular vote. Maybe John would do that, but it's up to the states. 38 states have to vote to amend the Constitution for it to become true. That's because we have these numbers built in. And that's also why the Electoral College will probably never be amended, because there are more than 13 little states, the smallest states, that like it and would never approve an amendment to the Constitution. So I don't think practically it would ever happen. But we have the amendment process, and like I say, John, good luck, because I don't think realistically you're going to have 13 or 14 small states say, yeah, you're right, we want to give up the power that we have.
Well, this is my last question for you both. John Nichols, how likely is it that we'll change the way we elect our president? Do you see any way forward to, as you're arguing for, abolishing the Electoral College?
Of course I do. I'm an American. I believe in the possibilities of this country. And I would suggest that small states might well lead in this process. I have a feeling that Vermont, our second smallest state in population, and Rhode Island, our smallest state in size, might be very inclined to get rid of an electoral college that has twice in the last 16 years allowed a Republican who was defeated for president of the United States in the popular vote to become president. And so I think, yes, it is possible. And you ask me how possible? Well, I would say it's at least as possible as getting votes for African-American men after the Civil War, getting votes for women in 1920. We have made tremendous strides as a country, sometimes in very difficult circumstances, sometimes in really divisive moments, because ultimately it was what needed to be done. And I promise you, abolishing the Electoral College is something that needs to be done.
Kirby Wilbur, what about you?
I'd agree with John. I think there's a possibility, and I believe in the system. And by all means, let's let the system speak, let the people in the state speak, the legislatures in the state speak, and like most right-of-center people, we'll accept the result of the election. We won't contest it. We'll accept it. If they pass 38 states to vote to amend the Constitution, abolish the Electoral College, so be it. you play the political game, you play in elections, you win, you lose. If you win, you get to celebrate. If you lose, you accept the results. And we would accept those results without protests, without demonstrations, because the people have spoken. But it serves this country well, and the people should have second thoughts before adjusting with a system that's provided stability, order, and liberty for so long.
That's Kirby Wilbur, host on KVI Talk Radio and former chair of the Washington State Republican Party. We also heard from John Nichols, the national affairs correspondent for The Nation. They were discussing whether the Electoral College still works. And across the country yesterday, electors voted, officially making Donald Trump the next president of the United States. Here in Washington, four of our 12 electors went rogue, casting their votes for someone other than Hillary Clinton, who won the popular vote in this state. Here are the results of yesterday's elector vote.
For the office of President of the United States, Hillary Clinton received 8 votes, Colin Powell received 3 votes, and Faith Spotted Eagle received 1 vote.
You probably know who Colin Powell is, but maybe not Faith Spotted Eagle. She's an elder of the Yankton Sioux Nation and a critic of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Faith Spotted Eagle told CNN the pipeline was slated to run through sacred burial land.
The most effective way we could get that point across is if all of a sudden the Ocheti Shakoi decided to build a project through Arlington Cemetery. And I think then the point would be taken that you don't disturb people that have been put to rest.
Washington elector Robert Satayakum, a member of the Puyallup tribe, voted for Faith Spotted Eagle yesterday, and she's reportedly the first Native American woman to receive a vote for president in the Electoral College. Long Beach, Washington has a problem, one that's shared by other low-lying coastal places in the Northwest. If a tsunami hits, townspeople and visitors likely couldn't reach high ground in time to escape. So in Long Beach, the city is moving ahead with a plan to bring the high ground to them. KUOW correspondent Tom Bonzi explains how.
To begin with, let's do the numbers. A magnitude 9 full rip of the offshore Cascadia earthquake fault, that unleashes a large tsunami. Emergency planners estimate the first waves would wash over the Long Beach Peninsula about 20 to 25 minutes after the earth stops shaking. You can assume the roads are buckled or blocked. High ground is more than 2 miles away from the Long Beach city core, out of reach of all but determined runners. Civil engineer Ryan Johnson has an alternative.
So this is going to be a 32-foot vertical evacuation berm that's going to allow students and community members to evacuate and get to higher ground quickly.
I met Johnson next to an old ball field behind the Long Beach Elementary School. This is where he's drawn up plans on behalf of the city for the elevated tsunami safe haven. The design is essentially an armored, triangular, man-made hill, which Johnson calls a modified prow.
The pointed prow of the ship will be looking off toward the ocean, and we can actually utilize that shape in order to break the oncoming tsunami and kind of knock down the run-up on the structure.
I also think of it a little bit as like a kite-flying hill.
It could be a kite-flying hill. Mm. Once you get up to the top of it, you'll be able to see all the way to the ocean, and you'll be high enough that there won't be any structures higher.
Long Beach City Hall hosted an open house last week where townspeople could look over the preferred design. Corinne Crone can imagine the berm being her salvation.
I mean, it would be great. You'd be alive. Compared to a wave taking you away, you know, you'd be alive. That would be great.
Locksmith and part-time Long Beach councilman Stephen Lindhart imagines it would be terrifying to ride out a tsunami on top of the proposed berm. But he says it's also a big improvement over the existing alternatives.
Because most people here are retirement age people. They're not going to run. And a lot of the people here are disabled. Again, they're not going to run. So whatever we can do to help bring that hill closer to our population, I think that's what we need to do.
Long Beach's city administrator says some taxpayers have complained that tsunami refuge will be a waste of money, but none of them came to the open house. The small town's biggest problem for now is raising the money to launch construction. City leaders estimate a total cost of $2.5 million for permitting, design, and construction. City Councilwoman Natalie Hansen says they've got $1.5 million already, mostly from a federal grant, but that leaves $1 million more to scrounge up, which is not chump change in a two-stoplight town.
I would say we're certainly a couple of years away by the time we get funding and start groundbreaking.
This tsunami refuge berm would be the first of its kind in North America. There are several in Japan. The flat top of this mini mountain could hold at least 850 people. A University of Washington tsunami planning project, though, calculated up to 12 more spaced-out engineered safe havens could be needed to save everyone at risk on the Long Beach Peninsula. In Westport, Washington, up the coast, the school district built a new gym with a tsunami refuge on top of the roof. The extra-strong building was dedicated last June. Meanwhile, down in Cannon Beach, Oregon, city leaders rejected as too expensive a design for a new elevated city hall with an evacuation platform on top. I'm Tom Bonsi in Long Beach, Washington.
You're with The Record on KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. And right now, I'm looking at the rules for something called the Feminist Fight Club. Here is rule number one. You must talk about Feminist Fight Club. Here is rule number two. You must talk about Feminist Fight Club. Now, Jessica Bennett, author of the book Feminist Fight Club, you changed the rules because 10 years ago, the rule was do not talk about Feminist Fight Club. So why make the change?
Right. And of course, the rule, the first rule of the actual Fight Club is not to talk about the Fight Club.
Right.
So the Feminist Fight Club is a real group. It's a number of women that I've been meeting with since I began my career about a decade ago in New York City. And we would gather monthly and we would talk about some of the issues of sexism that we were facing in our respective workplaces. And at the time, you know, it wasn't that long ago, but it was long enough ago that there were women who were members of the club who really did feel that if it got out that they were in a feminist group in their workplaces, they would be penalized at worst and stigmatized at best. And so we didn't talk about the club. But of course, as time has gone on, it's become more and more important to talk about these issues openly.
What do you think we gain by talking about stuff that you talk about in your actual Feminist Fight Club openly?
Well, you know, the book tackles sexism in workplaces, and the idea is to provide tools and tactics for overcoming some of it. And so to me, often what we see today is not necessarily overt sexism, though, of course, that may be changing in our current political climate. But so long throughout my career, a lot of what I've experienced has been very subtle sexism, and sometimes it's hard to call out. And oftentimes it's unconscious. You know, we hear sociologists these days talk about unconscious bias and implicit bias, this idea that all of us, women and men, have biases, whether they relate to gender or to race. And the first step to overcoming biases, well, it's acknowledging that they exist. So talking about the club, talking about sexism, I think is the first step toward overcoming it.
I want to talk to you a little bit more about what that subtle sexism you just mentioned looks like when you first became aware of it. But in the book, even though you are very clear about the fact that we must talk about it, you actually keep the identities of your real Feminist Fight Club members private. You change their names. You sort of change some of their identifying characteristics. Why did you do that? Why keep their identity secret still after all these years?
In part, I didn't want to distract from the issues. You know, their names and their respective workplaces would probably distract from the issues at hand, which was that we were all facing various forms of sexism in our workplaces. So we do talk openly about the club, but I didn't feel the need to identify people personally.
I'm talking with Jessica Bennett. She's the author of the book Feminist Fight Club, an Office Survival Manual. And your earliest work experiences were here in Seattle. You interned here at KUOW. I won't ask you to talk about any experiences you had here, but you also worked at the Seattle PI back when it was a print newspaper.
RIP.
I know. But when you first started working, did you walk in knowing that you were going to be facing sexism, that that was still, I guess, that that was still a thing that you were going to have to contend with?
No. And, you know, I grew up with your typical Seattle existence, very liberal, progressive, feminist parents. So feminist, in fact, that we didn't really talk about feminism. It was just assumed and implied that I could accomplish anything my brothers could. And in fact, I did. You know, I excelled in college and in internships. And it really wasn't until my first job at Newsweek magazine in New York City, my first real staff job, when I was there for a longer period of time, that I started to notice that I wasn't rising up as quickly as my male peers. And so some of it was things like noticing that I would pitch a story and it would appear on the pages of the magazine, you know, months later or weeks later under a male byline when I'd been told that it wasn't a good idea. Or things like not feeling comfortable speaking up in meetings because they were constantly dominated by white men. And then eventually it became unearthing things like knowing that a male colleague with the exact same title and job duties was making thousands and thousands of dollars more than me, and realizing that, okay, maybe I am a feminist. Maybe feminism is important and I need to start talking about it.
Was there a tipping point for you, though? I mean, you just cited a lot of examples of that more subtle sexism that you mentioned earlier. But was there a moment when you were like, oh, this is not just me, there's something else going on here?
This had been bubbling up for a while. And in fact, it wasn't just me, but it was a number of young female writers who were very frustrated. And the tipping point for us was actually discovering the story of a 40-year-old lawsuit by the women of Newsweek magazine who had sued the company for gender discrimination in the year 1970. And we didn't know that this existed. And yet these women, who at the time were told blatantly that women do not become writers at Newsweek, that is a man's job, so you can be a secretary or you can be a researcher or a quote-unquote male girl, and then you'll hand your notes over to the men. And yet they sued, and theirs was the first lawsuit of its kind, and it paved the way for female journalists. And so learning about their story and reading about it from the time and then actually tracking down those women and interviewing them, we realized that this was a collective thing and an institutional problem that had been happening at our workplace anyway for decades. And so that was the moment where we realized, okay, maybe this isn't individual. Maybe this isn't just us. Maybe this is actually a collective problem.
So how did you go from knowing in your workplace there was actually a documented history of this problem to realizing I have to talk to other women who are working and are having similar experiences? How did the club coalesce?
So we felt a bit like Newsweek had been this ground zero for what was happening culturally. And it had happened at the time in the 1970s because after the women of Newsweek sued their company, the women of the New York Times sued and the women of Time magazine sued and Sports Illustrated and the Ladies' Home Journal. And for us, at the moment that this was happening, this was in 2010, this was right after David Letterman had been found to be sleeping with his assistant. And there was a gender discrimination lawsuit at the New York Post. And there had been a big report put out by Maria Shriver's Foundation about the state of gender equality and just how far we were from it. And so there were all of these things swirling in the culture. And so there was a parallel there between what had happened then and what was happening now.
Jessica, I said that the subtitle of your book is an office survival manual. There are lots of techniques, strategies, ways of thinking about how to deal with things if you encounter sexism at work. But you also did a lot of research. You looked for evidence that sexism is still an issue in many workplaces. And I don't know, I guess this is a spoiler alert. You found a lot of evidence that sexism still exists in many workplaces. Gender wage gaps, how often women get interrupted at work compared to men. As you were looking at all of this research to write the book, what surprised you the most?
I think what surprised me was just how prevalent and unconscious a lot of this is. You know, I was beginning at a baseline. The subtitle is An Office Survival Manual for a Sexist Workplace. So I'm assuming that your workplace is sexist because the data shows that it probably is. That doesn't mean you're a sexist or your boss is a sexist. Maybe this is unconscious. Maybe this is institutional. You know, it does take time for industries to catch up to the fact that women were long not working in them. So if we begin there, every workplace is sexist, then we have to look at ways to overcome it. And sometimes these are large things like fighting for higher minimum wage and making sure that pay is equal between women and men and having better parental leave policies that apply to both women and men so that this is not just a women's issue. And yet there are all these subtle, smaller things. I call it death by a thousand small cuts that happen every day. Things like women being interrupted twice as frequently as men when they speak, or the fact that even in a mixed gender setting where there are women and men and you are talking about ideas, if a good idea emerges from the group, all of us, both women and men, are likely to assume that that idea came from the man. And so we have these subtle biases that exist and they're pervasive.
I'm talking with Jessica Bennett. She's the author of the book Feminist Fight Club, an office survival manual for a sexist workplace, as you just reminded me. And you've got strategies, you've got scenarios in the book. You suggest that people not read it from page to page, but just drop in where they might need it. But you also do a lot of live conversations to promote the book. And women ask you for advice on how to deal with their own workplace situations all the time. How do you handle that? Now that you've become sort of the go-to person for advice on how to deal with situations in a sexist workplace.
Right. It's a lot of pressure, you know, and I worked for a long time in a corporate environment, but I now work from home as a freelance writer. So mostly I'm just having these conversations with my dog. But no, you know, my big thing is as a journalist, I didn't want to give my own personal advice. The book is written in my voice, of course, and it tells stories of women that I've interviewed, but it's rooted in social science data. And so there's not a single bit of advice in there that isn't backed up by research. And so what I try to do when offering advice is provide people with information, fact-based information, that can make them more informed going in to deal with some of this stuff. So, you know, I don't always have the answers, and oftentimes I don't know exactly what to advise. But what I do know is there's a lot of research around this. And what I hope that I was able to do in the book is distill it in a way that might actually be digestible and fun to read.
Okay, you just said it's a lot of pressure when people ask you how to deal with their own workplace scenarios. I'm going to do that to you.
Okay.
We got a Facebook message from one of our listeners named Allie, and she writes, I've been a wedding photographer for 7 years, and often at weddings, there will be a male guest with his camera. And when I'm working with my clients or shooting details, he'll come over, show me a few photos on his camera, and then explain to me how he got them just in case I wanted to get a few tips. And she says that she's never asked how long she's been a wedding photographer. She's often asked by men if this is her real job. And she says it's hard not to get really defensive because I have male colleagues who do not experience this. And Allie didn't specifically ask for help in dealing with that scenario. But I'm really curious, in that scenario, what would you do? What do you think is a good response?
It's so frustrating. This is the kind of stuff that women deal with on a day-to-day basis. And she's a wedding photographer. But imagine being a female engineer and constantly being questioned about whether you're actually an engineer because we assume that engineers are male. So what it sounds like she's describing is the case of a mansplainer, which is a man who explains something in a condescending or pedantic manner that you already know. And this is not a term that I came up with, but it's one that has raced across the internet and become part of the pop lexicon. And I actually think it's pretty useful in the sense that suddenly we have this sort of silly term that we can use to describe what is kind of a complex and hard to explain, no pun intended, behavior. And so in that scenario, I don't know, ignore them or maybe be like, awesome, thanks for mansplaining that to me.
Just call them out for what's happening.
You know,
there.
I think calling it out is never a bad thing. And he probably won't do it again.
Probably not.
That's, I mean, one would hope.
That's pretty good advice, I think. I'm talking with Jessica Bennett. She's a journalist. She's the author of the book Feminist Fight Club, an office survival manual for a sexist workplace. And this was, the book came out of, as we said before, an actual real club. You, other women in New York, met, you called yourselves the Feminist Fight Club. Does that still exist? Does that group still meet?
It does. It still meets monthly, sometimes every other month, depending on how busy we are. And yeah, you know, some of our issues have changed. We've risen up the ranks. We're more senior. A lot of what we face now are issues of being in charge or being a female boss and the double standards that often come along with that. Or, you know, there are women in the group with children now, and how do you balance those things? And what if your workplace doesn't have a good policy that gives you time off? So some of the issues have changed, but the group continues to meet, and I don't think we'll ever stop.
We talked on the phone yesterday, and you mentioned that you've had a couple of meetings with the Feminist Fight Club since the election. What have those meetings been like?
Yeah, you know, I've made no secret about my political leanings in this election, and most of the women in that group had those same affiliations. And so we were all very disappointed, and we didn't quite know what to do. So we met a couple of days after, and like we normally do, we sat around in a circle. We typically meet at one of the members' mother's houses because all of us have very small apartments, and so we have to fit somewhere. And, you know, there's wine and cheese. And in this case, we sat around and we passed around a note card, and everyone had to answer. And so it was name, feeling, question, and action. And the idea was we wanted to talk about how we were feeling. We wanted to present questions about what to do next. And then we wanted to leave there with something actionable. And, you know, none of us are activists. Most of us are in creative fields. But there's a lot of amazing art coming out of this election. And what we wanted to do was feel like we were in some way contributing or making a difference or listening. And so a lot of what that meeting ended up being was us talking about how we could better listen. You know, for me as a journalist, I was a bit smug, I think, in assuming that Hillary Clinton was just going to win. And I think I was out of touch as well, because clearly that was not the case. Clearly there are many people in this country who did not support her. And so I think all of us coming from, you know, production industries, journalism, television, we need to do better about listening. And so there were some women who, you know, made commitments to, for documentary films, travel around parts of America that are outside of our New York City bubble. And there were others who decided they were going to help organize the Women's March on Washington on January 21st. And so the idea was to come out of there with an action.
Speaking of action, I am imagining men listening to this interview thinking, I am not the enemy. I try to be a good guy. So how does a man become a part of the Feminist Fight Club?
There's a very strong men's auxiliary to the Feminist Fight Club, and we welcome men to apply. No, just kidding. There's no application process formally. And in fact, if you want to be a member, like, consider yourself in. We need all the men that we can get as part of this battle. And I think that male allies are so, so important to this struggle. And in your workplace, men are typically, you know, unfortunately, it's sometimes still the leaders. And so if you can have them on your side, then they can actually really affect change. And I think that the reality is that, you know, despite words like mansplaining and manterrupting and this sort of humor in pitting men as the enemy, men are actually hugely, hugely important allies. And we have to encourage them to talk openly about these issues. It's okay to screw up sometimes, but they're so important to this struggle.
So if a man notices another man mansplaining, he can call that other man out for being a mansplainer, too. This is not just a word that belongs to women, yes?
Exactly. And probably he won't be called a nag after he does it.
Jessica Bennett, thank you so much. This has been really fun.
Thanks for having me.
Jessica Bennett is the author of the book Feminist Fight Club, an office survival manual for a sexist workplace. And she and I will talk again at Town Hall Seattle on December 27th. We're tweeting out a link to that event now. This is The Record. Here lies love. Those are the only words former Philippines First Lady Imelda Marcos wants on her tombstone. But they're also the title of a musical about her life by singer and Talking Heads frontman David Byrne. The Seattle Repertory Theater will stage Byrne's production of Here Lies Love in April. David Byrne visited Seattle earlier this month and talked with Ross Reynolds.
It seems like an obvious question. Why is David Byrne, former frontman for the Talking Heads, member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, doing a musical about former Philippines First Lady Imelda Marcos?
Wow. Okay. I read that Imelda Marcos loved going to discos, loved going to dance clubs and discos. And more than that, she had a mirror ball in her New York townhouse. she transformed the roof of the palace in Manila into a dance club. So I thought, here's somebody who is totally immersed in a very particular kind of music. But I thought, okay, if there is a story there, let's see if it would work to surround that story or tell that story through that kind of music that she already surrounds herself with. And did some research, and I thought, okay, yeah, I think there is. I think there's a way to do this, and it should be done where you're in the club with her.
David Byrne says he was drawn to the way Imelda Marcos expresses herself. The lyrics to the music of Here Lies Love are largely drawn from Imelda Marcos' own words.
A woman knows relationships. That's why I make my little trip.
Yes, those are all her words. Those are all her words that... There was a Islamic uprising in the in one of the islands in the south of the Philippines, and she decided the way to stop it. She felt like Libya was supporting it, and she said, "I'm going to go talk to Gaddafi, and we'll sort this out." And it worked. She charmed him, and it worked. And so she said, "Okay, see, handbag diplomacy," she called it. Yeah, and Gaddafi, he was just a mama's boy.
Gaddafi is easy, and I'll tell you why. A woman knows just how to do. Only rub his leg. He understood my point of view.
The real regime of Philippines First Lady Imelda and President Ferdinand Marcos was brutal. The Marcos government reportedly killed more than 3,000 opponents, including two Philippine labor organizers here in Seattle. They tortured tens of thousands of people and stole up to $10 billion in government funds. In 1986, a peaceful revolution deposed Ferdinand Marcos and Imelda. Imelda is now 87 and a senator in the Philippine Congress. All that's in Here Lies Love. But David Byrne focuses less on history, more on the charismatic Imelda Marcos and her words.
One called Star and Slave, which, again, her words, where she decides to, she says that she's going to dedicate her life to serving the Philippine people and that she's going to be their star and their slave. And I thought, boy, that's pretty perfect. That's a song title right there.
Let me be.
David Byrne wrote Here Lies Love as a show staged in a dance club, but for a long time, no one would give him a stage.
And I tried for years and didn't succeed. And then before putting it on the shelf forever, I thought, I'm going to record, ask really great singers to interpret songs that I think are right for them, sort of cast them according to the song. And that's what I did.
He recorded the concept album Here Lies Love in 2010 with an all-star cast, including Florence Welch, Tori Amos, the late Sharon Jones, and Cyndi Lauper. The Here Lies Love album was a hit, and in 2013, the Public Theater in New York finally gave David Byrne a stage. Or rather, the dance club setting he wanted for his musical, with the audience standing and dancing. Now Here Lies Love is coming to the Seattle Repertory Theater. It presents a challenge to artistic director Braden Abraham. How do you convert a conventional theater where the audience seating sloped down to the stage into a nightclub with the stage in the middle and the audience dancing around it?
Well, we're about to find out. we've engaged an architect. It's going to be like nothing we've ever done before.
David Byrne doesn't want the staging to scare off the audience.
They shouldn't be afraid, although they might think of immersive theater as being something where they get dragged on stage and a mic shoved in their face. No, that's
not going to happen. Yeah.
That does not happen. There's no intent. You're still an audience member, even though the cast is sometimes moving among you. That said, better to wear comfortable shoes.
There will be dancing.
Yeah, there will be dancing.
The David Byrne musical, Here Lies Love, opens at the Seattle Repertory Theater in April. Ross Reynolds produced our story. This is The Record from KUOW. Back in a minute. I'm Jeannie Yandel, and you're with The Record on KUOW. And now we're going to hear about what it takes to make a dream a reality. From Suzanne Gwynn, she's been a nurse for 33 years, working mostly with children here in Seattle. And Gwynn says hospitals do a great job at providing medicine and treatment. But for terminally ill kids, there comes a time when medicine can no longer help. And for a long time, Gwynn had an idea to make end-of-life care for kids better. A hospice, just for them and their families. Gwynn called it Ladybug House. But it wasn't until a few years ago that something happened to push Suzanne Gwynn into action, caring for a little boy with leukemia named Junior.
They would come to the hospital all together, and they would stay at the hospital until 12, 1, 2 in the morning walking the halls, because it's okay to walk the halls. It's not okay for the families to sleep at the hospital. Then when they would get so tired, they would go to Ronald McDonald House, but they would return about 7 in the morning because now it's visiting hours. Then they would all go to sleep and wake up at about 3 or 4 in the afternoon. So that was his morning time now. So his insulin and all of his morning medications were given at 3, 4, 5 in the afternoon. And it wasn't actually until after his passing and talking about it that I realized, I'm like, God, they used to stay up so late and they used to come so early. And I realized they wanted to spend as little time away that they could. They wanted to be a family together. When they would come back in the evening, you know, in the afternoon, mom would bring meals and she would cook and she would bring it and sit there. Well, 3 years ago, Father's Day, I swear it was the stroke of midnight. And just as I gave him his bone marrow transplant, I was also there the minute he died. And through some miracle, the supervisor allowed us to go, my coworker and I, to go to Harborview, and we picked up a travel permit for him, because his parents did not want to be in the hospital any longer. And we bathed his body. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, we put him on a gurney and took him to the loading dock and put him in the back of his truck. And we laid him on his brother's and his sister's lap. And his parents drove him back to Yakima.
How did that help you understand that things could have been very different from them mm-hmm. if a place like Ladybug House existed?
Mm-hmm. If Ladybug House had existed, he was still going to die. But that sense of this family always wanting to be together, that sense of taking care of their child, at Ladybug House, it would be a place where they would all be in a family suite together, where we would have that interlocking bed and make that family bed, where they could all be in the room and all cuddle. And then that sense of ritual could be there where their mom and this family could help take care of him. There would be no sense of urgency to leave because this would be their home away from home. And when they were ready and with dignity, not in the backseat of a truck, not that that was wrong because the parents and family did it with love, but because they had no other choice, that was the only way they could do it. When Ladybug House exists, families will no longer have to do that.
How long have you talked about a place like this needing to exist? How long have you been having these conversations?
A little over 20 years now.
but you didn't start acting until 3.5 years ago, I think. I guess what took you so long to go from thinking this is necessary to I'm the one who needs to do this?
Because it's so big. It's so big. It's like somebody out there should do this. So, you know, every time I'd meet, you know, a lawyer, an attorney, or a parent would come in, or a relative, you know, that I thought, oh, they have a really big boat on Lake Union. Maybe they have the money to build a house, you know, or, oh, they're really connected with government, or, oh, you know, you would say like, hey, somebody should build a house. Hey, these families need a place to be. Hey, we need something a little cozier. Hey, they deserve something better than the nurse trying to get the security guard to open the kitchen during the middle of the night to get them something to eat. And so, you know, after telling all of these people, you just realize, like, this isn't going to happen unless I do it. So I went to SCORE, the Seattle Business Association, and took a class on how to start a nonprofit. And I got Nonprofit for Dummies and for my daughter for Christmas. And I started going to a bunch of workshops, and I talked to people for a year. What do you think? What do you think? What do you think? How do you do this? What do you do? And it really was, you just start. But it's, if not me, then who? And if not now, then when? And, you know, I think in the last 18 months, I'm not speaking for Suzanne, and I'm not speaking for Ladybug House. I'm speaking for all of those kids that I took care of who would have used it, the ones who could use it now, and the ones in the future who will, because this is not going away. You know, unfortunately and sadly, children are dying. And they will die every day. What we can do is make that death and that perception of death and the reality just a little bit better.
You said that you finally got to the point where you were saying, if not me, who?
Mm-hmm.
What brought you to that point?
I think Junior had a big thing to do with it, the boy. Putting him on that gurney. I loved him a lot. I've loved a lot of these kids. You know, we had a boy who was a hemophiliac, and he needed a heart transplant. And when you're hemophiliac, you're not getting a heart transplant. And he was 20, so we had him on a drip that kept his heart pumping for him. And he tried to go home and ended up back in the hospital because a pump stopped one time and scared his family to death. So after about 8 months of living in a room by himself with his family visiting when they could, he decided to shut the pump off. And, you know, it wasn't that he wouldn't have died. He was still going to die. But maybe instead of his uncle playing, you know, his band, mariachi band, playing at his funeral, maybe it could have played in the backyard of Ladybug House. Maybe it would have happened 6 or 8 months later. Or maybe it would have happened at the same time. But his brothers could have spent the night. His aunts and uncles could have had barbecues in the yard. You know, they could have all slept over and been together there.
You carry the stories of these families with you. Mm-hmm. That's clear. It's not easy for me to hear some of those stories, mm-hmm. but I can't imagine what it would be like to have to call them up and tell them again when you're trying to build a case for why a place like Ladybug House is necessary. What is it like to have to tell these stories again and again? To talk, I mean, you are talking about a thing people do not want to talk about.
Thank you for recognizing that. I tell people because people say, tell a story. But they're really not a story. They're a memory. So I do have to go inside myself. And I have to take myself back to that place and that moment. And just like with Junior when he was 5 and had the remote control car zooming up and down the hospital hallways, and his mother would bring me tamales in, and his dad's nickname for me was Lazy, and I'm like, oh my God, do not say that. But it was a joke because I used to bust my butt with his son who was so sick. And so they would get to the hospital and the first thing they would is like, is Lazy working? I'm like, oh my God, don't say that. So, you know, and it's hard. You go in there and I go back almost 30 years with those kids who live in my heart.
What kind of response do you get when you talk to people mm-hmm. about this?
Most people shut down, or it's just too sad, or can you make it less sad? So, you know, going out there and asking for support is really hard. I feel like Sometimes I feel like I need to, like, take a drum and stand outside the mall like everybody else and start banging and saying, like, I understand there are amazing nonprofits out there. There are. We have food banks and shelters and sex trade and abuse and so many things are in need of funding. But this isn't another one of something. This is something that doesn't exist. We don't have one. Not one. We have two in the entire country. We don't even have a hospice policy for kids in our country. So here, you know, when you're talking to people and it's just too sad, can you change the words? Can you not tell that story? I have to. How can I not tell that story? Could you please listen? Could you hear me? Could you hear my voice? Because tomorrow, when you go to the doctor because you think your child's growing pains is just a shin splint, it could be bone cancer, you know? It could be leukemia. It could be heart disease. It could be diabetes. It could be so many things. Tomorrow, this could be your world. And if this were your child or your grandchild or your niece or your nephew, and you were going through this, you would want something like Ladybug House to exist.
Suzanne Gwynn is the founder of Ladybug House. She's still looking for land and funding to make Ladybug House a reality. This has been The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel, in for Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.